Chapter 12. I have already mentioned some of the stages which we go through when attempting to understand what we are. In my second life, I, in a rather cliched display, killed myself to make it cease, and in my third life, I sought an answer from God. I have said that I went to some pains to find very dull, safe positions during the Second World War. What I have not stated is that the war also offered an opportunity to learn some more about the limits of my present learning. Thus, from a Jamaican engineer by the questionable name of Friday Boy, I heard about the souls of the dead and the angry ghosts that stay behind when they are not honoured. From a very earnest American officer called Walter S. Brody came the mysteries of baptism, Anabaptism, Mormonism and Lutheranism, laid out with the conclusion, "My ma was all of them at some time, and what she learned is that the best way to talk to God is by yourself." A Sudanese soldier who had hauled baggage for Rommel's retreating tanks in Tunisia before escaping, or perhaps being captured, the rumour was never clarified, showed me the way to Mecca. He told me how to recite the words, "I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is God's servant and his messenger," first in English, then broken Arabic, and finally, Akoli, which he proudly declared was a language like no other, and he, being Muslim and Akoli, was a man like no other. I recited this last several times to try and get the intonation right, and when he was satisfied, he slapped me on the back and proclaimed, "There, maybe you won't have to burn in hellfire after all." I think it was this soldier, more than the others, who encouraged me to travel. He told fantastical, and as it frequently turned out, entirely fictional tales of glorious lands beyond the Mediterranean Sea, of mysteries and answers waiting in the sands. When the war ended, I found the first ship I could to these lands that so many Englishmen were leaving, and, drunk on the times, stumbled through various misdeeds and adventures with a blind ignorance worthy of the youth I appeared to wear. In Egypt, I became passionately convinced of the truth of Allah's word, until one day I was cornered in an alley in Cairo and beaten senseless by three of my brothers from the mosque. They pulled my beard out and shaved my head with dull knives, spat in my face and tore at my ill-fitting white robes, which I had acquired with the zealousness of the convert, proclaiming that I was a Jewish spy, albeit a ginger one, an imperialist, a communist, a fascist, a Zionist, and above all else, not one of them. I spent 4 days in hospital, and on my discharge went to my mullah for comfort. He politely poured me tea in a glass tulip cup and asked me how I felt about my calling. I left the next day. In the newly founded state of Israel, I toyed for a while with Judaism, but for all my war-wounded credentials in the cause of Hebrew espionage, I was clearly not about to belong, and my status as an ex-soldier of the hated British did me few enough services. I saw men and women with camp tattoos still blue on their skins, who fell to their knees beneath the wailing wall and wept with relief to see its sun-drenched stones, and knew that I was not a part of their universe. A Catholic priest on top of Mount Sinai greeted me when I climbed it in search of a god to answer my prayers. I knelt at his feet and kissed his hand and said his being there was a sign that there was a god who had a purpose for me, and I told him my story. Then he knelt at my feet and kissed my hand and said I was a sign from God, that there was a purpose to his life after all, and that in me his faith was renewed. And he became so earnest in his declarations of my wonder that I began to doubt it myself. He said he would take me to Rome to meet the Pope, that I would have a life of meditation and prayer to fathom the mysteries of my existence. And 3 days later, I woke to find him on the floor of my room, naked except for a string of beads, kneeling and kissing my hand as I slept. He said I was a messenger and apologised that he had ever harboured any doubts, and I sneaked out of the back window and down the garden wall just before sunrise. I headed to India, having heard tales of mysticism and philosophies which might perhaps succeed in explaining my situation where Western theology had failed. I arrived in 1953, securing a job easily as a mechanic for an endlessly failing succession of commercial airlines. Their failure rarely affected me. I could leave work on a Monday, employed by one man, only to come in for work on a Tuesday to find my old contract destroyed and a new, perfect copy waiting to be signed. All clauses exactly the same, except for the date and name of employer. India was settling down from its partition, and I was in the South, away from the worst of the bloodshed that had stained her independence. Nehru was Prime Minister, and I found myself madly in love. First with an actress whose eyes seemed to look at me and only me from the silver screen, and then with a look-alike girl who sold fruit at the airport and hadn't a word of any significance, who I idolized abjectly and courted disastrously. It has been observed among even the oldest of our kind that a certain biological incentive drives us, regardless of the ages of our mind. As a child, I had felt only a biological incentive to grow and be intellectually despondent at the same. As a teenager, I had fought depression with occupation and the conspiracies of the Hune household. Now, as a man in the prime of life, the urge was upon me more than ever before to go out into the world and challenge it like a bullfighter in the ring. I travelled in search of answers, argued with men who argued back, loved from the pit of my soul, and was rejected to the bottom of my heart, and idolized Meena Kumari, Bollywood goddess, as a symbol of perfection, though I spoke not a word of Hindi when first I saw her films. Answers failed to arise from either love or God. I spoke of resurrection and reincarnation with the Brahmins, and they told me that if I lived a good and pure life, I could return as something greater than myself. And what about myself? Can I return as me? This question caused quite a stir among the wise men of Hinduism to whom I put it. I like to think that I introduced the first inklings of relativistic physics into their discourse, as academics sat up earnestly debating the question of whether resurrection needed to be temporarily linear in nature. Finally, the answer came back from one wise man with a big belly and very neat eating habits, who proclaimed, "Don't be ridiculous, English. You get better or you get worse, but all things change." This answer gave me little satisfaction, and with my savings from 10 years repairing the same jet with a weekly different name, I moved on. China was hardly welcoming, and my timing was poor in terms of visiting Tibet, so I headed south, dodging around Vietnam, Thailand, Myanmar, and Nepal, judging my moves on the basis of whether the Americans would not be invading, or a civil war was not imminently going to break out. I shaved my head and ate only vegetables, learned to pray out loud with impossible words, and asked every permutation of every Buddha, from the one Gautama to his 10,000 aspects, why I was what I was, and whether this death would be my last. I acquired something of a reputation, the Englishman who knew the discourse of all faiths, who could argue with any monk or imam, padre or priest, on any philosophical topic they could raise, as long as it pertained to the immortal soul. In 1969, I was visited by a cheerful man with round glasses, who sat cross-legged from me in my hut, and proclaimed,
"Good evening, revered sir. My name is Shen. I am with a concerned institution, and I'm here to ask you what your intentions are."
I was living in Bangkok at the time, having discovered that no amount of purity of prayer could alleviate the misery of tropical molds growing in the folds of your skin during a wet jungle life. The newspapers carried stories of the government's greatness in big, bold letters, and whispers of communist guerrillas in the hills in far smaller letters of somber black. I did not know if I believed that the Eightfold Path would bring me enlightenment, but I knew that I was getting too old to believe anything else, so divided my time between fixing cars in my orange robes and meditating on what I would do if I could not die. Mr. Shen, face like a polished conker and blue shirt sticky with sweat down the back and beneath his arms, pushed his glasses a little higher up his face and added,
"Are you here to engage in counter-revolutionary activities?"
I had gone through a phase of cultivating wise, mystic answers, but frankly, one gets too old for such things, so blurted,
"Are you with the Chinese security services?"
"Of course, revered sir," he intoned, bowing from his seated pose, hands together, in the custom that is respectful for Thais addressing a teacher. "We have very little interest in this country, but it has been suggested by some that you are in fact a Western imperialist agent intending to ally with such counter-revolutionary forces as bourgeois separatist the Dalai Lama, and that your temple is a hub of capitalist subversion created to strike at the heart of our glorious people."
He spoke all this so pleasantly that I was forced to ask, "Isn't that bad?"
"Of course it's bad, revered sir. It would be the kind of subversive activity that would prompt retaliation from my government, though of course,"
a flash of bright, cheerful smile,
"you would naturally be protected by your imperialist allies, and there would doubtless be repercussions."
"Oh!" I exclaimed, realization dawning. "You're threatening to kill me?"
"I would hate to go so far, revered sir, not least as I personally believe that you are merely an eccentric Englishman looking for an easy time.
How would you kill me? I asked. Would it be quick?
I would hope so, yes. Unlike your propaganda, we are not barbarians.
Would I have to know about it? If you were to say, kill me painlessly in my sleep, would that be an option?
A look of consternation flashed across Shen's face as he considered this.
I imagine it would be politic for everyone involved if we could make your death seem both painless and natural. Your being awake would doubtless lead to a struggle and signs of self-defense, which would be unacceptable in a monk, even an imperialist pig monk. You're not an imperialist pig, are you?
I am English, I pointed out.
There are good English communists.
I'm not communist.
Shen chewed his lower lip uncertainly, eyes darting round the edge of the room, as if he half expected to find a crack in the bamboo walls through which a rifle might appear. Then, in a rather more hushed voice,
I am hoping that you aren't an imperialist agent, revered sir, he murmured. I was asked to compile the case file against you, and I couldn't find any evidence that you were more or less than a harmless madman with old-fashioned beliefs. It would be a poor reflection on my paperwork if you were to turn out to be a spy.
I'm definitely not a spy, I assured him.
He looked relieved.
Thank you, sir, he exclaimed,
wiping his forehead with his sleeve, and then hastily bobbing an apology for this act of sweaty disrespect.
It did seem very unlikely, but you have to be thorough, times being as they are.
May I interest you in tea? I suggested.
No, thank you. I can't be seen fraternizing unnecessarily with the enemy.
I thought you said I wasn't the enemy.
You're ideologically corrupt, he corrected, but harmless.
So saying, and still bowing profusely, he made to leave.
Mr. Shen, I called after him.
He paused in the door, his face with the strained expression of a man who sincerely hopes that his desk is not about to become busier.
I cannot die, I explained politely. I am born, and I live, and I die, and I live again. But it is the same life.
Has your government got any information on this which may be of use to me?
He smiled, genuine relief flooding his features.
No, revered sir. Thank you for your cooperation.
Then, an afterthought.
Good luck with all that.
He let himself out. He was the first spy I have ever met, and Franklin Fearson was the second. Of the two, I think I preferred Shen.